EMSradio.com.
EMS information for the next generation. The EMS Research Podcast is a production of EMSradio.com.
Episode number 5 of the EMS Research Podcast. We're recording this on February 9th, 2011. My name is Harry Mueller. I'll be one of your hosts. Our topic tonight is pre-hospital fluid administration and trauma. Before we get into the research, I'd like to introduce tonight's panel. Tim Noonan, how are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing terrific. Tom Boothelet, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. How are you, Harry?
I'm great. I'm glad to have you on. And Bill Toon.
Good evening, Harry, Tom, and what is your name again? Oh, Tim, it's good to be here all tonight.
Excellent. This looking at this, this is an interesting paper, and now that we've all introduced ourselves, Tim agreed to summarize the paper for us to sort of give us some direction to our discussion. So take it away, Tim.
Okay, the interesting part of this was what was written in the newspapers. IVs kill patients and definitely don't do it. I am not a fan of giving a lot of fluid before going to the trauma center, but it's not what the study is really about. They're way of looking at this is they look through the National Trauma Database, which contains almost 1.5 million patients. They found about 800,000 trauma patients, and they examined what was done treatment-wise. Rather than look at whether they have IV fluid administered, they looked at whether an IV was documented as having been started on the patient, and they presumed that if you started an IV, you did it to give fluid, and if you started the IV, you actually did give fluid. So it's a little bit iffy on what the paper means and what people will take out of it, but if you go and just read the abstract, you may miss out on a lot of the information. If you read what's in the newspaper or in the online journals, you may miss out on a lot of it. A study they reference in it was by Bickel back in 1994, which Dr. Bickel's not really the name that sticks out from that one. Dr. Pepe and Dr. Maddox, because it was done at Ben Taub in Houston. That one looked at the amount of fluid that was given and found that they didn't do that well when they were given extra fluid. This study doesn't really add anything. There are some really interesting aspects of it, but all they did was they looked at the retrospective data. It's not a prospective study. About half of the patients got IVs, and you wonder how that happened in all of these patients, since no matter how they broke it down, there wasn't that much variation between those who got IVs and those who did not. It's as if they set up a prospective study, but the results are not based on prospective data. It just gives the look and feel of it without the substance. There's a bit to discuss, and let's move on to whoever has something they want to talk about.
Well, I'll jump right in there, and I think it's important here that we touch on the concept of what is a cohort. What is it to be, retrospective in nature? I think that understanding even some of those things talk a great deal. I wonder whose phone's ringing. That was strange. I just heard someone's phone ringing in the background. But I think the key message is here is retrospective. This was done all, as you said, by looking at a data bank of information. And so it was only patients that were enrolled in this data bank. That's the cohort. That's the group. It doesn't represent all trauma patients in the country. It only represents the ones that are in this data bank. And it also was done not concurrent or looking into the future. It was looking at outcomes that have already happened. So I think that just in sense of how strong is this study compared to the randomized, controlled, prospective, blinded type study, you know, it's a little lower on that scale of threshold there. So I just wanted to bring that in as the stop. So as the start, so I go and I look at this and I says, okay, it's something that happened in the past and it's based on this group that's in this data bank. So I don't necessarily jump up and down one way or the other.
Was anyone else surprised at the number of patients that received the military anti-shock trousers and how many people had their chest decompressed in the study?
I was just going to comment on that. The fact that, at least from the table I'm looking at, it looked like almost 50% of the patients got mast applied. And I'm trying to figure out whether that's just because of the timing of the study or whether this really was done in looking at patients coming from places that were not up to speed on the effectiveness of the military anti-shock garment.
Well, the more interesting thing about the mast is look at the patients with no IV. Only 0.19% of them got the mast, while 53% of the IV patients got the mast. And then when you look at the survival, the mast was not correlated with bad outcomes. So most of the IV patients got the mast, but the mast was not correlated with bad outcome. Kind of interesting. Mm.
Well, but, you know, even in the original work that was done with Pepe and Maddox and those people that even talked about mast trousers, they really it was really mast trousers and used in penetrating chest trauma or penetrating trauma above the mast trousers and showed the negative effect that took place with that that subset of patients. And when you even go back, and even if you talk to Pepe, he'll say it said that this is where masks were not effective. There is still out there, and there is some good stuff, that there is a subset of patients that mask trousers do have an indication for. We probably were using them in too broad of an application that drew some negative aspects to it. So as I look at this and being somewhat of an old dog, no, I'm not surprised.
Well, maybe I'm misreading the study, guys, but it looks to me like the same number of patients were backboarded as had their chest decompressed. How could only 8.1% of all these trauma patients have had their spine immobilized? That makes zero sense to me whatsoever.
That is an interesting oddity, and I'm wondering if that's just a data entry problem, although that's a pretty huge variation just for a data entry problem. It really makes you wonder.
Because honestly, the few times I've used mast trousers in my career, the patient's always been on the backboard. But this shows 28.6% in this registry had the mast trousers, but it shows only 8.1% that had their spine immobilized and also 8.1% that had their chest decompressed. So I'm almost forced to conclude that's got to be a misprint.
But when you look at the other chart on the next page, table 2, it shows similar numbers. The no IV group had 4.2% were spinal immobilized, and the IV group was 11.5%. So you averaged those out since there were about half in each group, and it does work out to about 8%. So it doesn't seem like it's just an error entering the numbers.
Yeah, it's very interesting numbers, and I'm not sure what to make of it.
Well, it's interesting for me because obviously EMS is practiced radically different around the country from what I'm accustomed to.
That's an excellent point that you bring up there is that EMS is really not plain vanilla across the country. There is a huge amount of variations, and they found that even in the ROC study when they looked at the cardiac arrest outcomes. They can't understand even in the ROC consortium why there's such a dramatic difference in survival outcomes across all the participants in the ROC study. So I'm not surprised that EMS is done dramatically different state to state, then county to county, and then community to community. It can be dramatically different. And as you said, you were surprised to see the use of the mask trousers. And, you know, there are places that it's still even part of the curriculum, and people have to be tested on and evaluated on it. You know, it really depends on where you are in your community, or where do you live.
Another interesting part is that they said we did not adjust for cardiopulmonary resuscitation because the data on cardiopulmonary resuscitation appeared to be biologically implausible. Well, when I read that, I thought, okay, they're kind of explaining that in trauma, the problem is no blood, so doing chest compressions doesn't matter. Or it's an obstruction, such as cardiac tamponade or tension pneumothorax, and you've got the same problem. No blood is moving, so why compress? But they continue that with the mean systolic blood pressure of penetrating trauma patients who received cardiopulmonary resuscitation was 118 millimeters of mercury. Why are they doing chest compressions on somebody who's got a systolic pressure of around 120?
This is the challenge that's faced with this kind of study and presentation, this cohort meta-analysis almost of this data, that it doesn't give you the precision that you may be interested in trying to get to.
Well, if I may then, if this study is basically my understanding, and I did read the study, they did not find a single subset for whom a presumed IV fluid resuscitation was beneficial. Are we agreed on that point?
No, I'll agree with that.
Yes. So that's sort of the claim.
They state that.
Okay, so if we could just move past the methodology for a moment, I have a question because I would have to say, anecdotally in my career, I have seen way too many ambulances on the side of the road with paramedics starting IVs on trauma patients and not doing them en route to the hospital. So if it is true that pre-hospital IVs for trauma patients do not seem to confer a survival benefit, then why the delay?
Because it makes us.
That's a very good question, and I am not able to come up with a good answer. Why we delay, transport to the surgeon who is the one person that these trauma patients really need to see to start an IV. And I believe they did mention that in the discussion further on that they felt that if IVs were going to be started, they should be done on the move while you're transporting rather than standing still.
But we've all known that.
92%. They said there was a 92% success rate starting IVs en route on the move.
But I went through paramedic school in 1995. And that was stressed then, and I can only imagine that it was stressed prior to 1995.
It was stressed very heavily in 1985.
Okay. So we've known for 25 years, probably more, that IVs on trauma patients were not a priority. And yet, I have to admit, looking back throughout my career, many times I've seen paramedics starting them on the side of the road without getting en route. So I don't know. You know, intuitively, that seems like it would be a bad thing. I'm not sure about the methodology in the study. I guess I can think of many occasions on medical patients where a fluid resuscitation is indicated, a patient with heat exhaustion, a patient with right ventricular infarction, sepsis. When is it appropriate for us to bolus a trauma patient with fluid in the era of permissive hypotension? And if it is not clear that it's benefiting patients, you know, it's interesting that they went through the trouble of saying, you know, across all subcategories, it caused harm. But their conclusion was pretty weak, I thought. They just basically challenged the idea that all trauma patients should get an IV. Well, their data shows that none of them should get an IV. So I was a little confused by the disconnect between their research and their conclusion. It seemed kind of limp-wristed to me.
You know, I think it's as I'm listening to this, is I think severity, the kind of wound, there's a whole number of things. Imagine, and again, I think I was influenced by somewhat of Pepe's conversations over the years that I've heard, is that if you have someone that, let's say, lacerates their brachial artery and spills a liter or two of fluid on the ground, but you come and you can control that, and you put in an IV and you put back in fluid into the container, that individual often does well because you were able to control the actual point where the hemorrhage is at. I think the challenge, exactly. I think the challenge comes in the trauma patient where you don't know where the bleeding is. Is the bleeding coming from you know, half a dozen intercostal arteries that have been traumatized and are bleeding into the chest, or is it the spleen is all broken up? You know, I think that there it's a much more unclear what the role might be for fluid. I don't think anyone would disagree that trauma patients need to have whatever hemorrhaging that they have going on controlled, and that the more ideal thing to do is give them something that has an oxygen carrying capacity, and crystalloids just don't do that for us. So I think that this, again, I'm not surprised by what they said here in the study nowadays, and I just wanted to let you know, pre PHTLS and pre 1980, it wasn't unusual for us in that period of time to spend time and try to stabilize trauma patients in the field, because we believe we were capable of doing that. And I'm showing my age now, but again, it took courses like ATLS and PHTLS to make that move away, that this wasn't the best way to deal with trauma patients, that you can't treat a trauma patient like you do a medical patient. They're two entirely different animals and stuff. So, again, there you'd have to find some pretty old dogs to remember the way it used to be, but you're correct. All of you have said, is I think the curriculums have strongly leaned a long tier period of time ago, is that trauma is best handled ideally in a trauma center with the appropriate type of trauma system in place to be able to manage the patient, and that the role of fluid in pre-hospital environment is probably very limited.
What?
Limited to, like, say, circulatory collapse.
Maybe limited to even the description I just gave you, where it was clearly an isolated injury, you could control it, and you could fill the tank back up. Versus someone who was stabbed in the chest, you have no idea where the bleeding is going on, and that letting them be permissively hypotensive, or even what we think is hypotensive, letting them stay that way, starting IVs but not giving any fluids just so the hospital has access to them when you get in route, don't take the time on the scene, and go to the hospital.
And that's the original paper in 94 by Maddox and Pepe and Bickel said, they did not come up with any particular number where they felt it was appropriate to give fluid until after the bleeding was controlled. One of the things I've seen is chest wounds. We apply pressure to the rib cage, and we think we're controlling bleeding, even though the bleeding is well within the rib cage, and all we're doing is putting pressure on the ribs and controlling the capillary bleeding while the bleeding is going on within the rib cage, and we think we have bleeding controlled. We think we're doing something other than putting on a show for bystanders. We need to limit the fluid administration probably to where the bleeding is controlled. And there are still people, even PHTLS and ATLS trained people, who are saying you got to give lots of fluid because that's the way the old timers have done it, and that's what they're trying to be like. There's just no good evidence for it. All we're doing is pleasing ourselves by dumping fluid in to raise the blood pressure when we get to the trauma center, even though that may have more harm than benefit to the patient.
Now, it does need to be said, although the study claimed that the result was significant, and I suppose with the total number of patients enrolled, even a fraction of a percent is, but we're really only talking about 0.3%, right? This was from 4.5 to 4.8% was the mortality difference between the two groups. And that
but
seems...
it wasn't looking at fluid administration. It was looking at whether an IV was documented as having started.
Okay.
And they presumed that that meant that fluid was given.
Okay,
on some patients, I start IVs all the time, but I almost never give fluid boluses.
Okay, so Tim, if these patients received an IV but did not receive a fluid bolus, it would either have to be the time delay to definitive care in starting the IV, or an infection, right? I mean, what else would there be? You've got a delay, you've got a possible infection, or you've got some kind of deleterious effect to a fluid bolus. Can you guys think of anything else it could be?
Or the information is collected in a way that it is not able to provide the answer that we're looking for.
Well, it could be a flawed study as well. I mean, you've got me there. That's why I'm saying collectively here, you know, what are our indications truly in the field? Clearly, if you need to secure the airway and you're an EMS system that performs RSI, you're going to need a med route. Hence, you're going to need an IV. We have the situation that Bill brought up of a hemorrhage that can be controlled. And so there's a theoretical patient that might benefit from a fluid resuscitation. Who else?
Well, if you had a true distributive shock, and I use that term broadly, but a true spinal cord shock, those are patients that, you know, the container is intact. It's just profoundly dilated that they could use, and if you read the stuff there, they would benefit from large amounts of fluids as well as pressors. But again, we sometimes don't even have that ability to determine if the patient's unconscious or do they have a spinal cord injury and that's what's causing their shock.
CHF patients who have been given Lasix?
I think one of the other things that I found lacking in the study, and I think the authors stated that they didn't come up with a good way to compensate for it, is you don't know what the time is. You don't have a good idea on transport time, so we can separate out the urban calls where it is going to take you longer to start the line than it is to get to a trauma center versus the rural areas where even to get to the community hospital, you can have a 20, 30, 40 minute or longer transport time. I'm not saying that the rural patient requires fluid resuscitation, but that can certainly make a difference as to whether it's appropriate to even go the IV access route or just transport without an IV. And I think that can skew the data slightly.
The numbers don't give us the information that we need. And, you know, you look at all the irregularities in the data, you've got almost three times as many patients getting a needle decompression as get intubated. You have the same number of patients getting needle decompression as get spinal immobilization. The numbers don't make sense. So what should we draw from this as a conclusion? That this is not the database that answers the questions. Maybe when they have better control of the information that goes into it, but right now it doesn't answer our questions.
Well, you know, I'm sorry, Tom, go ahead, please.
Well, that's okay. Bill, I was just going to say it's not as though you would want to make wholesale changes to the way EMS does things based on the results of one single retrospective analysis anyway. But I guess what I was going to say, Bill, is if the study itself is confusing for us, I'm wondering about our listeners, what they might take away. And I guess what I'm thinking is something along the lines that it isn't clear that IV therapy benefits trauma patients. Can we agree on that? So I guess I'm hoping that if they take something actionable away from our podcast this evening, it is if they are the guys like, hey, you know, I'm not saying I've never done it. I try to minimize scene times. I've seen it more as a supervisor since I've been promoted to the position of lieutenant, where I'm taking more of an incident command role on scene. I see a lot of ambulance spending a lot of time on some trauma calls where I kind of think in the back of my mind, you know, they probably ought to get it on the road. This would be a good call to action, I think, to say, hey, if we've been told since 1985 or prior that IVs are a low priority with trauma patients, this study reaffirms that. So if there's a disparity between what you've been taught to do in school and what's actually happening out in the field in your EMS system, maybe this is a good time to just address that and say, you know what? If you're starting an IV just because they like you to have one at the hospital, they'll get over it.
Not every place is like that. There are some places where they will have a fit if you show up without two large bore IVs and they want to know how much fluid you've given the patient. I had a patient who was apparently uninjured, but his blood pressure was 80. He had been ejected from a vehicle in a rollover, but no signs of any injuries, up and walking around before I get there. And I put a line in him and transported him. And you know, big thing they wanted to know is, how much fluid have you given him? His pressure is 80. Like, yeah, his pressure was 80 when I got there. Pressure hasn't changed, and it's been a 20-minute ride and 10-minute scene time, and his pressure is still 80. And, you know, whatever is not in the bag, 5, 10 cc's, I didn't want to give too much, you know. They were stunned. You know, this is not the way their medics do things. But there was no indication for fluid. Why should we believe that a pressure of 80 is something that we need to correct before we get to the hospital, before they get to the operating room? We shouldn't. Maybe a pressure of 60, maybe 40. Even the paper by Pepe and Maddox and Bickel in 94 said that they would not put any particular number on when pre-hospital fluid should be given, that they didn't find any support for any particular number as a cutoff for when we should start giving fluid pre-hospital.
Well, I guess the question at that point is there an, should there be a number, or should we be looking at other indicators to tell us whether we ought to be giving the patient fluid at all? I know my Israeli colleagues don't give fluid to anybody who doesn't have an altered mental status. Is that a reliable indicator?
Not necessarily. If you're thinking head trauma, and head trauma patients tend not to do well with low blood pressure, that would be one reason for bolusing somebody with a suspected head injury. And that's an entirely different group of patients to be thinking about.
Well, PHTLS says maintain peripheral pulses, correct? Give just enough to maintain a radial pulse.
But is that a good idea?
Well, I don't know. But in the absence of any other type of guidance, I think it's supportable.
Do you know, Tom, I'm going to go back to your statement. What is the take home that we want to give to the listeners here from this study is that I think your thing is that there that the role of pre-hospital fluid administration is not, you know, defined by this study alone, but it seems, and it seems strongly, that it is better probably to give far less than more and use the opportunity to efficiently and safely get people to the appropriate facility, and the appropriate facility in my mind is a trauma center, is probably the best practice, and that the seminal position statement is still isn't out there yet. And so there will be some systems that will do just like Tim said. They'll have two large bore lines and they'll give lots of fluids, and there's others where they won't do it, they won't do anything at all except take the person to the trauma center. So I think that it seems that the word, should we be giving fluid? Probably not. You know, not in any excessive amount.
One thing they cite in the study is a paper called Fluid Resuscitation in Pre-Hospital Trauma Care, a Consensus View, which was from 2002 in the Emergency Medicine Journal, which is a British paper, and they seem to be the ones leading the way on the major changes, such as oxygen and fluids in pre-hospital treatment. What they said in writing about this paper is another consensus paper asserts that IV fluid should not be administered in penetrating trauma patients if a central pulse is present, and that under no circumstances should IV administration delay transport. So they're not interested in a peripheral pulse, only a central pulse. So
which
they've
would
got
be
a pulse someplace, carotid.
Yeah.
If they've got a pulse someplace, don't dump fluid into them. And that's a consensus paper from the trauma people in England.
Well, I guess it's a good time then for everybody to go back and just read their own protocols, kind of refresh them and bring it up with their medical directors and determine how they're going to do it. I think eliminating inconsistency is good for any system. To me, a safe system is one where everyone does it the same way across all three shifts or however many shifts there are. Otherwise, it's the Wild West and everyone's doing it their own way, and then the medical director has no control. So, you know, maybe it'd be a good time to just kind of go back and decide what the criteria is going to be and emphasize minimizing the scene times.
That's a good point. You know, we need to look and minimize the scene times. I think this is also a call for more research to be done. I think we need to look at this more and try and determine whether it is a time factor or whether it is the fact that we're actually starting the IV and giving this patient any amount of fluid to determine what the factor is that increases the mortality rate.
Is it just the way the data is collected? Because the chest decompression rate is unreasonably high, and while I don't think we should be doing spinal immobilization, it's surprisingly
low. We'll discuss that next
study.
Well, I think that I'm going to throw out here that I think that for our purposes now, I think we've sort of, at least amongst the four of us, have reached a consensus and have beat this this paper up pretty good. I think that maybe what we do is, you know, move on from this point, unless someone has something big to bring up. I have nothing wrong with us having a short and concise, to the point discussion tonight, and you know, move on to.
I think that's reasonable.
Our parting comments.
Bill, did you have anything else you wanted to add?
I would just say that I think it's certainly worth reading through. It's certainly worth making sure that your medical director sees this article and you have a discussion with him, and then you see what your protocol practices are as it relates to this and see if there might be considerations for some tweaking. But I agree with you that the big thing is that it would be nice for them if we could see some concrete research that would give the pre-hospital care personnel the guidance that they're looking for so it could be definitively practiced across the
country.
Tom,
any closing comments?
We don't necessarily change the way we do things based on the results of one study unless it is a truly definitive study. But the first rule of medicine is do no harm. So whether it's a study about tracheal intubation or mass trousers or pre-hospital fluid administration or possibly fluid administration. And when evidence starts to surface that we may be causing harm, I think it is incumbent upon all of us to keep a critical eye on what we're doing and strive for best practices just in case we are harming patients. And just kind of take it from there. Go forward with our eyes wide open.
Tim, anything you want to close with?
We provide too many treatments because of wishful thinking. Somebody came up with the idea that fluids were a good idea, and we have not had any good evidence to support giving fluids to trauma patients. This doesn't really debunk it, I think, but we never had good reasons for giving fluid. It was, hey, they're losing fluid, we should give fluid. That's not really the case, as Bill was saying. You need to control the bleeding before you start adding fluid. The title of this paper should not have been Pre-Hospital Intravenous Fluid Administration, but pre-hospital IV starts are associated with higher mortality in trauma patients. And that's all they really
I think my
at.
Only comments in closing will be that while I didn't think this paper really proved anything one way or the other, I thought it was thought-provoking and really could serve as the jump-off point for some additional research. And the last thing I want to add in is please don't change your treatment just because we've outlined a paper. We're not your medical director. But definitely bring this to the attention of your medical director and your managers and your service chiefs and say, do we want to think about this? Do we want to look into this further? All right. So that sounds like that's been a pretty good discussion. Tim Noonan, where can people find you?
RogueMedic.com and Paramedicine101.com. And
excellent. Tom Berthelet, where can people locate you on the internet and get in touch with you?
EMS12lead.com, and they can email me at EMS12lead@gmail.com. And they can find me on Twitter at EMS12lead. Or they can come to EMS Today 2011,
Bill
too.
Where are you?
There.
Well, I'm in Oz, of course, but probably what I want to encourage people to do is use our Facebook site as a way to contact me. You also can use the EMS Educast Facebook site as two very good ways to contact me, and then that way it allows all of us to see what's being said and commented about. And then you can follow me. I'm not quite the avid Twitterer as some people, but I'm on Twitter at WF Tunes. Great. So those are good locations to track me
my
down.
My blog is inactive, so I'm not going to talk about it. I am on Twitter at TheMacMedic, and people can reach me, TheMacMedic@gmail.com. That being said, this has been Episode 5 of the EMS Research Podcast. You can find us on the web, ResearchEMS.com. We're on Twitter at EMS ResearchCast. Search Facebook for EMS Research. If you want to email us comments, emsresearchcast@gmail.com. You can Skype us at EMS ResearchCast or contact us by plain old telephone at 603-397-0367. Again, this has been Episode 5 of the EMS Research Podcast. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to having you listen to us again. Things in life are free. You can keep it for the birds and bees. Now give me money. Now give me money. That's what I want.